Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents J.A. Johnstone's The Loner, narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Kimberly Gilbert, Dan Stevens, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Yasmin Toison, Stephen Carpenter, Thomas Keegan, Joe Brack, Johann Detweiler, Ken Jackson, Mort Shelby, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, and Joseph Thornhill. The Loner, Book 2. The Devil's Badland.
Thunder rolled over the mountains. Lightning clawed through the gray-black sky above the peaks. It would be a dark, violent night, the young man thought as he slapped the reins against the buggy horse's back. That was entirely appropriate, because dark nights of the soul were the only kind he knew. The storm was still a ways behind him. He hoped he could reach his destination before it caught up with him. If not, he would have to seek shelter, which would delay him on his journey. That would be an annoyance, but not a major setback. The woman he was going to see would wait for him. She had no choice. She was dead. The approaching storm made the late afternoon gloom even deeper. The young man spotted a flicker of yellow light up ahead. Even with a new century only a few years away, civilization spread to much of what was once a lawless frontier. That part of southern New Mexico territory was still sparsely settled. The ranches there were far flung, isolated. The light had to come from a ranch house, or maybe a sodbuster's adobe shack, because there, as elsewhere, farmers were moving in on what had been open range until a few years earlier. A hard gust of wind rattled the buggy's canvas top. No rain was falling yet, but the young man could smell it coming. He realized he couldn't make it to the mission at Valverde before the storm overtook him. Better to head for that house where the light shone and see if he could spend the night there while the storm rolled through, then go on to Valverde in the morning. The light flickered again. Either the wind was blowing the flame or someone was moving back and forth in front of it. The young man pulled back on the left rein, turning the horse and buggy toward the light. Thunder boomed again. Lightning cracked. But those sounds didn't come from the storm behind him, the young man realized suddenly as he saw a muzzle flame spurt in the gloom. That booming sound wasn't thunder. It was a shotgun being discharged. Those sharp cracks that followed came from six guns and rifles. A pitched battle was going on right in front of him. The smart thing to do would be to veer away, go around whatever the trouble was, and keep heading south as long as the weather would allow. It had been a while since he'd worried much about doing the smart thing. He leaned forward and slashed the horse's back with the reins.
Yeah!
Rory McTavish blinked his eyes against the sting of powder smoke and nestled his cheek on the smooth wood of the Winchester's stock. He peered over the barrel he had thrust through the rifle slit in the dugout's front wall and waited for a target. He didn't have to wait long. A moment later, one of Whitfield's men darted across the open ground between the corral and the smokehouse. That took him right in front of Rory's gun sights. With the speedy reflexes of the young, the boy pulled the trigger. The Winchester kicked hard against Rory's shoulder. Even though he knew to expect it because he'd been hunting many times in his 15 years, he still had to bite back a yelp of pain. He'd always been scrawny, without much padding against such impacts.
Good shooting, lad! You downed the scallyhooter!
Rory looked through the slit and saw the gunman crawling back toward the corral, dragging a wounded leg behind him.
Now kill him! Get him before he gets away!
Yeah.
Rory swallowed hard. His pa was right, of course. He couldn't pass up an opportunity to kill a Whitfield man. But Rory had never actually killed any man, let alone one who rode for Devil Dave Whitfield.
Ah, should have known.
The old muzzle loader in Hamish's hands blasted, and even in the fading light, Rory saw the Whitfield man jerk under the impact of the heavy lead ball that blasted away a chunk of his skull. The man sprawled face down on the ground near the corral as rain began to fall. Rory had heard the scorn in Hamish McTavish's voice just now. He should have known that he couldn't trust his son to be a real man. That was what Hamish really meant.
It's starting to rain. I expect they'll be charging us now. They won't want to get wet, the bloody spalpeens.
Let them come.
Rory's older brother James poked a long-barreled Remington revolver through a loophole. He carried the Americanized version of their father's name, since he, like Rory and their sister Margaret, had been born here long after Hamish had immigrated to this country. It had been James who had opened the ball by loosing both barrels of the old double-barreled greener at Whitfield's men. The rancher's gun wolves had shown up to accuse the McTavishes once again of stealing Circle D cattle. And when Hamish and James argued, one of the gunmen reached for his Colt. That had been enough to make James's finger jerk the scattergun's triggers. The weapon had lived up to its nickname by scattering the hired killers and giving Hamish and James time to retreat into the dugout.
Easier to kill them that way.
Ah, yes, Rory thought as he worked the Winchester's lever. James was a son after his father's own heart. Margaret came up behind him.
Do you need more bullets?
Rory glanced over his shoulder at her. She was 17, 2 years older than he was, and 2 years younger than James. There had been 6 children in the family, but the 2 youngest, a boy and a girl, had died of illness in childhood without ever reaching 8 years old. The oldest, Charlie, had been killed 2 months earlier in a shootout with one of Whitfield's gunslingers in Valverde. The loss still put a bitter taste in Rory's mouth whenever he thought about it. So he tried not to think about it, even now when they might all be on the verge of being wiped out by Whitfield's men. He hung onto the rifle with his right hand and thrust his left into the box in Margaret's hands. He took out a dozen cartridges and shoved them into his pocket.
Here they come!
Rory leaned forward, put his cheek against the rifle stock again, and waited to kill his first man. It didn't have to come to this. That thought went through his head as he saw men rush out from behind the barn and the corral and charge toward the dugout, orange flames spurting from their guns and splitting the stormy twilight. If his father and Dave Whitfield had been able to sit down and talk things over like reasonable men, but the chance to be reasonable had vanished along with Whitfield's missing cattle. It had died with Charlie McTavish. Hatred and the spilling of blood were all that was left. Rory tried not to cry as he pulled the trigger, but the tears welled from his eyes anyway. The storm was suddenly right on top of the little ranch, with thunder rumbling so loudly it shook the earth, lightning flashing to compete with the muzzle flames, and rain falling from the heavens in drenching, sluicing waves. Rory no longer aimed his rifle at men, but at vague gray shapes instead. Shapes that brandished weapons of their own as they poured lead at the house. Then something loomed out of the gathering shadows and cut through the attackers, scattering them again. Rory held his fire as he saw more muzzle flashes, but these shots weren't aimed at the dugout. Instead, they sent Whitfield's men running for cover. Rory realized that a buggy had just raced into the yard. Amazingly, the man had only one hand on the reins. The revolver in his other hand spat fire and lead.
Who's that?
I dinna ken. But he's on our side, so more power to him, I say.
The stranger's unexpected attack had broken the back of the charge. Whitfield's men fled as the stranger's uncannily accurate shots broke arms and tore through legs. The man in the buggy wasn't shooting to kill, Rory saw, but he was inflicting plenty of damage anyway. Damage that had Whitfield's men turning tail and running, taking their dead and wounded with them.
Yeah, right!
James ran to the door. He flung it open and dashed out into the rain to throw some shots after their enemies.
Be careful, James!
James didn't pay any attention to her. He was too caught up in the heat of battle. Hamish went out too, tossing aside his rifle and pulling an old pistol from behind his belt.
Paul!
Margaret turned to Rory.
I suppose you'll be chasing after them like a madman now, too.
If they're going out, I can't stay in here, Maggie.
Rory had endured enough scorn from his father and brother for one day. Jacking another round into the Winchester's chamber, he hurried to the door and out into the pounding rain. force of the storm half blinded him and almost knocked him off his feet. The wind wasn't blowing that hard. It was the sheer power of the rain itself that almost drove him to his knees. He struggled to stay upright and looked around for any of Whitfield's men who were still in range. The only people he saw were his father and James and the man in the buggy, who had swung down from the seat and stood next to the vehicle with a Colt revolver in his hand. The stranger was hatless, but with the rain in his eyes, Rory couldn't tell much more about him except that he was tall and dressed in a dark suit. The downpour had plastered the man's fair hair to his head.
They're gone, and we're much obliged to you for your help, mister. Come on into the house out of this storm.
I have to see to my horses.
The man gestured toward the buggy, where a big black was hitched to the vehicle and a rangy buckskin was tied on behind.
Ah, the boy can do that for you. Rory, take the man's horses into the barn.
You got it.
Unlike killing, that was a chore he could handle. Rory handed his rifle to James, then grabbed the black's bridle and led the horse toward the barn. The buckskin followed along behind the buggy. Rory swung the big door open. It was a relief to step inside out of the rain. He was soaked to the skin. Using one of the matches and a little box hung from a nail by a string, Rory lit the lantern. Quickly, he went about unhitching the black and leading him and the buckskin into a pair of empty stalls. Once, all six stalls in the barn had been full, but money problems had forced his father to sell off most of their horses. Only a couple of mounts were left. 15 minutes later, Rory had rubbed the horses down, dumped grain into the feed troughs, and filled water buckets from the barrel. With the animals taken care of, he walked over to the buggy and glanced curiously into the vehicle. He saw an obviously expensive saddle behind the seat, along with a fine new Winchester and a heavy-looking older rifle Rory thought was a Sharps. The stranger was well-to-do, plain enough. Rory couldn't help but wonder why the man had come along and taken a hand in their trouble. According to Hamish McTavish, the rich didn't give a damn about anyone except themselves. They sure wouldn't care about a family of poor Scots trying to make a go of a hard-scrabble ranch. But this man evidently did. Rory left the barn and headed for the dugout, anxious to learn more about this stranger who had shown up out of the storm to rout Devil Dave's gun wolves with a blazing Colt. Built into the side of a hill, the dugout that served as the home of the McTavishes was larger and less primitive than most folk might have expected. Hamish, Charlie, and James had used thick beams for the roof, then sealed it and the walls with pitch before mounding the dirt and stone over it again. It didn't leak even in a downpour like this, which was more than could be said for the barn. A chimney extended up through the hill from the large fireplace, where flames now leaped and danced, warming the big main room. The floor was stone, but Margaret had put down rugs to make it nicer and more comfortable. Except for the lack of windows, you'd hardly know that you weren't in a regular house. When Rory went in, he saw his father, James, and the stranger standing in front of the fireplace, drying their clothes in its heat. Margaret was on the other side of the room, rattling pots and pans in the kitchen as she prepared a meal for the menfolk.
Might I offer you a drink? As you might expect, I have some of the finest Scotch whiskey you find this side of the Highlands.
That sounds good.
The stranger looked around at Rory.
Who's this?
Me youngest. His name's Rory.
Hello, Rory. Thanks for putting up my horses. My name's Conrad Browning.
The boy hesitated, surprised that Conrad had offered to shake hands with him. He took Conrad's hand briefly, keeping his eyes downcast.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Browning.
Short and slender, Rory was a lot smaller than his big, brawny father and brother, but he had the same bushy red hair as Hamish and James, who had introduced themselves to Conrad while the boy was out at the barn tending to the horses. They had introduced Margaret as well, who shared the red hair and also possessed the same shyness as Rory. Conrad felt an instinctive liking for these people and was glad he'd stepped in to help them. He had faced a choice when he rolled up in the buggy just as the rain began falling in earnest. He had no way of knowing which side was in the right in this dispute, so he could cast his lot with the defenders inside the house built into the side of a hill, or with the attackers who were charging that dugout. Conrad had counted nearly a dozen men attacking the house, where only two or three defenders fired back. When in doubt, take up for the underdog, he had decided. But he had shot to wound, not to kill, just in case he found out later that he'd jumped into the fight on the wrong side. Looking around at the McTavishes, he couldn't believe that was the case. They appeared to be honest, hard-working settlers. The salt of the earth, as the old saying had it. The sort of people that Conrad Browning once would have looked down on with a sense of arrogant superiority. He liked to believe that he had changed, that he wasn't that sort of man anymore. But it didn't hurt to remind himself from time to time just what a son of a bitch he had been. Hamish McTavish dug around in an old trunk and came up with a dark brown bottle and a couple of glasses. He brought them over to the fireplace.
What about me, Pa?
You're too young for this, James.
Old enough to fight, ain't I?
Aye, but so's Rory. And you didn't see me giving him a drink, did you?
He ain't much of a fighter. He didn't kill any of Whitfield's men as far as I could see.
Conrad glanced at Rory to see if the youngster would say anything in his own defense. Rory just kept looking at the floor and didn't speak up. Turning back to Hamish, Conrad took the glass the man offered him. Hamish lifted his glass.
To your health, sir.
And to yours.
I told you it was good.
Oh, I never had any better in San Francisco or Boston.
That made Hamish beam.
Why were those men attacking you?
Hamish's smile disappeared.
Because they're hired killers working for a no-good bastard named Devil Dave Whitfield.
The local cattle baron?
Oh, he thinks he is, anyway. He doesn't ken that these days are over. That he can no longer run roughshod over the small ranchers. This is McTavish land, and McTavish land it'll stay.
It was an old story, Conrad thought, one that had been played out many times on the frontier. Despite what Hamish said, it nearly always ended the other way, with the richer, more powerful rancher triumphing over the owners of the smaller spreads. In fact, by this point, syndicates or corporations owned most of the large ranches, and companies always grew larger at the expense of individuals. At one point in his life, Conrad had believed that was the proper way for things to be, and he had enough experience in business to recognize the truth of the matter, whether he agreed with it now or not.
I hope you're right. I wonder if you could put me up for the night? The weather's still pretty bad out there, and I'm not sure the storm is going to let up until morning.
I wouldn't have sent you back out there in that deluge. You'd be welcome to spend the night. You could have my bunk.
Conrad started to tell the ranger that wasn't necessary, that he could just make up a bedroll on the floor. Then he remembered that the man Conrad Browning used to be, the man Conrad Browning was still supposed to be, wouldn't have reacted that way. That Conrad would have expected to be accommodated in the best possible manner.
Of course, I'll be glad to pay you.
Conrad's smile turned smug. That was something the old Conrad would have said, too.
It would be no necessary to do that.
Conrad knew that his offer of payment had just knocked him down a notch or two in Hamish's estimation, and that was a shame. Still, the game had to be played. Not that he expected to win, Conrad mused. In the big scheme of things, he had already lost before he ever started, because no matter what he did, Rebel would still be dead. His wife was gone. All Conrad could do was continue his quest to bring vengeance and justice to those responsible for her death. A little while later, they were all sitting at the dinner table, eating the stew Margaret prepared.
Whitfield's men will be back, you know. We killed at least one of them. That gunman called Hardesty. I saw you put a bullet in his head, Pa.
Hamish gave Rory a hard look.
Aye?
Conrad didn't know what that exchange was about, but he felt a little sorry for the boy, who never lifted his eyes from the bowl of stew. Conrad could tell from Rory's attitude that he knew his father was glaring at him, and he felt a pang of sympathy for Rory. He knew all too well what the tension between father and son was like.
This fellow Whitfield must have quite a grudge against you folks to send hired guns after you like that.
All over a bunch of blasted cows. He claimed that we stole them, but that was just his way of trying to get the law on his side so he could run us off our land.
So he accused you of rustling?
Aye, but we never did it. We never touched a one of his damn beeves.
James, that's no way to talk. Especially at the dinner table.
It's the truth! What Whitfield said was a lie, and Charlie was right to tell him to his face.
All that did was get Charlie killed. Was it worth it for him to call Whitfield a liar? Was it, James?
James scowled, but didn't say anything. These people had seen more than their share of hardship and tragedy, Conrad thought. But so had he. There was nothing else he could do to help them, not while his own mission was incomplete. Anyway, if he tried to involve himself too deeply in their problems, he'd probably just make things worse, he told himself. He had a history of bringing trouble down not only on himself, but also on those around him. You could ask his wife, Rebel, about that. Well, you could if she wasn't dead. The strained silence lasted for the rest of the meal. Yeah. When it was over, Hamish showed Conrad to a small room in the back of the dugout that contained little more than a narrow bunk.
"'Tis not much, but it's the best we can offer you, Mr. Browning."
"'It's fine. Thank you."
There was no door to the room, just a curtain like the other two bedrooms. One shared by the boys and the other for Margaret. A candle on a shelf provided light. Conrad undressed by its flickering glow. The heat from the fireplace had only partially dried his clothes, and he was glad to get the damp garments off. He wore a plain black gun belt while he was dressed in the dark, sober suit, although there was a different gun belt coiled in his saddlebags. He curled the one he had taken off around an equally plain black holster that held his Colt 45 Peacemaker and placed belt, holster, and gun on the floor next to the bunk, within easy reach if he needed the Colt. He didn't expect that to be the case tonight, but always being ready for trouble was a habit with him now. Conrad wrapped up in the blanket that was on the bunk, stretched out, and tried to sleep. As usual, that wasn't easy. As soon as he closed his eyes, images began to whirl through his brain. Awful images that he would just as soon never see again. But at the same time, a part of him clung to them, reluctant to let go of the pain, because that would mean letting go of the past, too, and he wasn't ready to do that. Rebel stood high atop the bluff that loomed over Black Rock Canyon. Behind her was the gunman, Clay Lasswell. Conrad had paid the ransom that was supposed to save her. The rest of the kidnappers already had their greedy hands on it. All that was left was for Lasswell to let her go. But instead...
Welcome to hell!
No!
The bullet tore into Rebel and knocked her off the bluff, so that she plummeted down toward the merciless ground below, falling, falling. The image in Conrad's mind changed. Now he was standing over one of the kidnappers, pressing the barrel of a Winchester to the man's head. He saw the man's eyes widen in horror and disbelief, then bulge out from the pressure as Conrad pulled the trigger and sent a bullet through the bastard's brain. That man wasn't the only one Conrad had killed in circumstances that might seem like cold-blooded murder to some people. He had killed even more in fair fights. Their faces swam before him now as he tried to sleep, but always that image of Rebel falling, followed by the memory of cradling her broken, lifeless body in his arms, returned to drive everything else away. Conrad dozed off and slept fitfully on the narrow bunk in the McTavish dugout, jerking from side to side as nightmares haunted his slumber. No matter how much he tried, he couldn't get away from the ghosts who pursued him. All the men he had killed chased him, their bullet-riddled forms closing in on him, and trying to get away from them, he ran toward the elusive form of his wife, still alive and vital, looking back at him with love shining in her eyes. But he could never catch up to her, and the dead men caught up to him instead, trying to pull him down like a pack of wolves. He fought against them, lashing out and driving them back until he had time to reach his gun. He drew the Colt and spun to face the grisly phantoms. The revolver came up, his finger tightened on the trigger.
Mr. Browning, no!
Conrad came awake and found himself staring into the terrified face of Margaret McTavish over the barrel of the Colt clutched in his sweating hand. His finger taut on the trigger, only a hair's breadth of pressure away from blowing the girl's brains out.
Please don't shoot.
Margaret stood in the doorway, one hand still on the curtain she had just pulled back.
Oh, dear Lord.
Horrified, Conrad took his finger off the trigger and quickly lowered the Colt.
Miss McTavish, I'm sorry. I never meant to threaten you. I wouldn't harm you.
And yet he almost had, Conrad thought. He had come within a whisker of shooting the girl, all because of the dreams that tormented him. Considering the words Margaret had screamed, Conrad wasn't surprised that Hamish had the shotgun in his hands and a furious look on his face. Under the circumstances, it was a father's natural assumption that the city slicker visitor was molesting his daughter. Hamish wasn't the only one who was armed. James had his Remington revolver, and even Rory clutched his Winchester.
What the devil's going on here? Is this the way you repay us for our hospitality, Browning? By being free and easy with the poor innocent girl?
Pa, no! It's not like that. I heard Mr. Browning thrashing around and thought he might be sick from getting drenched by the rain. But he was just having a nightmare
What your daughter is trying to tell you, Mr. McTavish, is that I almost shot her. You have my word, though. It was unintentional.
Oh, devil, a lot of good that would have done if you'd pulled the trigger.
That's true.
Conrad picked up the holster and slid the Colt back into the black leather. He'd become uncomfortably aware of the fact that he was sitting there naked except for the blanket wrapped around him.
I'll get dressed and leave now.
That's not necessary. You didn't mean it. You were asleep. You didn't know what you were doing.
Even so, I think it'll be better if I look for somewhere else to spend the night. I am grateful for the hospitality you've shown me, and I don't want anything to ruin that.
Margaret turned to her father.
Pa, you're not going to make Mr. Browning leave, are you? It's still raining out there. Pouring from the sound of it.
Aye, it is true. You did help us against Whitfield's men.
They probably would have made it into the house and killed all of us if Mr. Browning hadn't shown up when he did.
Conrad was a little surprised that the boy spoke up in his behalf when Rory wouldn't even defend himself, but he was grateful to the youngster for the gesture. James scowled at him.
I ain't sure it's a good idea. This fellow's a rich man. You can tell by looking at him. And you know that can't be trusted, Pa. Sure, he took our side against Whitfield's men, but that was because he didn't know what was going on. Now that he does, he's liable to turn on us.
Conrad felt a surge of anger. The accidental near shooting of Margaret was bad, he would grant them that, but he hadn't done anything else to make the McTavishes distrust him.
I'm not going to turn on you, James. I don't have any interest in your dispute with Whitfield. It's not my fight. I just pitched in because I don't like seeing anybody outnumbered that badly. Come morning, all I intend to do is head on down to Valverde. I have business there.
Rich man's business.
Being rich has got nothing to do with it. I'm going to visit my wife's grave.
He hadn't wanted to reveal that much, but once the words were out, a surprised silence fell over the dugout. Hamish and James frowned, while Margaret and Rory looked at Conrad with pity.
Ah, sorry I am to hear that you lost your missus. My own darling wife passed on 5 years ago, and not a day goes by when I didn't feel the pain of her passing. I reckon I misjudged you at first about what was going on with Maggie here.
Nothing was going on!
Margaret turned to Conrad.
Forgive me if I'm prying, Mr. Browning, but the nightmare, was it about your wife?
Conrad didn't want to hash everything out with these people, and he didn't want their pity either. Pity didn't change a damned thing.
I don't remember. I'm just sorry that I almost shot you. If I leave now, we can all be sure that it won't happen again.
But the storm!
I'll go sleep in the barn with my horses. It won't be the first time.
It won't. You could have fooled me. I figured a fellow like you would never have set foot in a barn, let alone slept in one.
Ah, that's enough, James! Mr. Browning has apologized for what happened, and he's offered to make sure it will not happen again. You cannot ask anything more of the man.
James's glare told Conrad that the young man didn't like being reprimanded like that.
I'm going back to bed.
You don't have to sleep in the barn.
I'd feel better about it if I do. The last thing I want is any sort of accident that might hurt one of you.
Well, then, I got an old piece of oilcloth you can hold over your head while you're running out there. It'll keep you from getting quite so wet.
You're sure about this, Mr. Browning?
I'm sure. Again, Miss McTavish, I'm very sorry for what happened.
And I'm sorry for your loss. If you'd like to talk about it...
I wouldn't.
Come on, then. Just leave the poor man alone.
Poor man, Conrad thought. That was the first time anybody'd called him that in, well, ever. At least that he could recall. And yet that's exactly what he was. Because no amount of money could ever replace what he had lost. Once Conrad had made it inside the barn, he found the matches Rory had told him about to light a lantern. Conrad climbed into the hayloft and made himself a bed in the straw. He blew out the lantern, stretched out on a blanket, and discovered it was surprisingly comfortable. Despite that, he didn't go to sleep right away. Too many nights in recent months had been spent drifting in and out of nightmares. Eventually, exhaustion would claim him. For the moment, though, his mind drifted back unbidden over everything that had happened to bring him to this time and place. For most of his life, he hadn't known who his real father was. His mother was Vivian Browning, and so he'd assumed that her husband was his father. He had been almost grown before he discovered that his real father was Frank Morgan, the notorious gunfighter known across the West as the Drifter. No one knew how many men Frank Morgan had killed. Songs had been written about him, and sleazy, money-hungry scribblers had penned dozens of lurid, yellow-backed dime novels featuring the Drifter. He was a bloody-handed hired gunman, at least in the minds of many, including scores of lawmen who didn't want him in their towns. That was the image Conrad had of Frank Morgan, so it was no surprise that he was horrified when he found out that Morgan was his father. His mother had revealed that fact to him while they were on a trip west, checking on her business interests. Then, only a short time later, Vivian Browning had been killed by outlaws. Frank Morgan had avenged her death, but not before some of those same desperados had kidnapped and tortured Conrad. Frank had rescued him, but despite that, Conrad didn't want anything to do with the man. It was bad enough they had to be related. But a day had come when Conrad needed Frank's help. Since they shared ownership of the businesses they had inherited from Vivian, it was only fair that Frank pitch in when there was trouble, especially when it was the sort of problem that was in his line of expertise. Someone had been raising hell with a railroad spur Conrad was building in New Mexico territory, and he needed the services of a good man with a gun. There was none better than Frank Morgan. It was during that adventure that Conrad had come to have some grudging respect for Frank. Not only that, but he had met and fallen in love with a beautiful Western girl named Rebel Callahan during that dust-up. Rebel thought the world of Frank Morgan, and that had influenced Conrad to get to know his father better. Along with the respect had come some affection. Frank and Conrad had come to be friends, even if they weren't as close as many fathers and sons were. After spending some time living in Boston, Conrad and Rebel had moved to Carson City, Nevada, and one of the reasons was so that they could see Frank more often. It had been an idyllic existence, right up until the night when more than a dozen outlaws had invaded their home and kidnapped Rebel, holding her for the ransom that Conrad was to deliver in Black Rock Canyon. He had taken the money with him when he drove out to the rugged canyon northwest of Carson City, but he had been prepared to fight, too. For the first time, perhaps, he had truly become Frank Morgan's son on that terrible night. It was terrible because Rebel had died. So had some of the kidnappers. The way things worked out, it appeared to the world at large that wealthy young businessman Conrad Browning was dead, too. That was fine with Conrad. He had assumed another identity in order to track down the kidnappers who had escaped. With the help of new friends, he had run the kidnappers to ground and killed them, one by one, until finally he caught up to the leader of the gang, Clay Laswell, the gunman who had killed Rebel. By that time, however, Conrad had figured out that Laswell had been acting on someone else's orders, some enemy who had set up Rebel's kidnapping in the first place. He wanted Laswell dead, but he also wanted to know who was truly to blame for what had happened. Fate had conspired against Conrad once again. Laswell had died, but without revealing the identity of the mastermind behind the kidnapping. For all the blood he had spilled, Conrad's vengeance was still hollow and unfulfilled. His true enemy was still out there somewhere. That was why Conrad Browning lived again. Rebel was buried in the Mission Cemetery in the small settlement of Valverde, east of Lordsburg. She'd been raised in the Davis Mountains of West Texas, where her father had a ranch, but the spread had gone under because of rustlers, and the family had moved to New Mexico territory. The Callahans had lived for a time in Valverde, and Rebel's brothers knew she had liked the place. They had chosen to have her buried there. Tom and Bob had been forced to make the arrangements because at the time, everyone believed Conrad to be dead. Conrad was on his way to visit his wife's grave, and he intended to do so right out in the open. He wanted everybody in Valverde to know why he was there. Whoever had set up Rebel's kidnapping hadn't been interested in the ransom money. That was just to pay off the Owl Hoots who had carried out the job. Laswell's actions in killing Rebel had made it clear that the real objective was to torture Conrad, to make him suffer the almost unendurable pain of watching his wife die. Someone had a damn strong grudge against Conrad Browning. That was why he intended to use himself for bait to lure them out into the open. And once he knew who it was... The killing wasn't over yet. It had just gotten started. Those thoughts whirled madly through Conrad's brain. Waking, sleeping, it made no difference. The painful memories were always there. He rolled onto his side. He would try to sleep now, but he didn't figure it would work out well. His eyes weren't closed for long. The sound was faint, and Conrad was sure that it hadn't come from inside the barn. That meant a horse was moving around outside somewhere, and where there was a horse, there was usually a rider. He couldn't think of a single good reason for somebody to be skulking around the McTavish place on a stormy night like that, but he could think of plenty of bad ones. Leaving the lantern unlit, Conrad reached out in the darkness and closed his hand around the butt of his gun. The Colt's grips fit his palm like they had grown there. He came up on his knees and crawled quickly over to the little door that allowed bales of hay to be lifted into the loft from outside. It had a simple latch on it. Conrad unfastened it and pushed the door open several inches. The rain was falling straight down now, since the wind had died away. The barn's eaves kept it from coming in the opening. Conrad's eyes narrowed as he peered through the wet, murky gloom. He saw several figures moving around near the dugout, but they were just deeper patches of darkness. He couldn't make out any details. Given the fact that he had heard a horse, though, he was fairly sure they were men on horseback. He leaned forward to watch them. Suddenly, despite the rain, a match flared to life. They had been shielding it somehow. Conrad saw hands moving in the harsh glare, holding something toward the flame. Conrad's hand tightened on the Colt as he realized what he was seeing. One of the men had just lit a fuse. The powder-laced length of cord would burn in spite of the rain. Conrad didn't waste any time wondering who the men were or what they intended to do. His keen brain understood instantly what was going on. Devil Dave Whitfield, or at least some of his men, had returned to the McTavish Ranch with the intention of blowing the dugout to Kingdom Come. Conrad quickly drew his Colt and took careful aim at the man with the dynamite. The man drew back his arm to hurl the explosive at the dugout. The man stiffened in the saddle.
Bowie! Bowie, damn fool!
Instead, the dynamite slipped from the wounded man's hand and fell to the ground at his horse's feet. The men stampeded, mud flying under the hooves of their horses as they tried to put as much distance as they could between themselves and the dynamite. The wounded man had the presence of mind to try to get away too, but he was too late. The explosion sent man and horse flying through the air.
In the barn! The son of a bitch is in the hayloft!
Conrad threw himself down as gun flame bloomed in the stormy night. He guessed there were three or four of the raiders left, and they were all doing their damnedest to kill him by blazing away at the hayloft door. Conrad poked the Colt through the opening and returned the fire. At the same time, shots roared from inside the dugout. The explosion had roused the McTavishes from sleep, and they were joining the fight. That put the raiders in a crossfire. A couple of them sagged in their saddles as if they were hit, even as they turned and fired back toward the dugout. After a moment, they realized they were in a bad spot. They wheeled their horses and put the spurs to the animals, galloping out of the muddy yard between the dugout and the barn. They left behind the man and the horse that had been caught in the blast. Neither dark shape on the ground was moving. Conrad figured both of them were dead. Working easily by feel, because he'd had plenty of practice these past few months, he thumbed fresh cartridges into the Colt to replace the ones he had fired. Then he climbed down from the hayloft and lit the lantern. Draping the oilcloth over his head and his left arm, he carried the lantern in that hand and the revolver in the other as he walked out of the barn. The dugout door opened. Hamish and James came out of the dwelling, wearing slickers and hooded ponchos. Hamish had the shotgun, James his Remington. They stopped on the other side of the bodies from Conrad, who held the lantern high enough for its yellow glow to spread over the gruesome sight. The man and the horse were torn up pretty badly.
That's another of Whitfield's men. I think his name is Duggan or something like that.
Dumont. He was there that day in Valverde. The day your brother...
They were going to blow in the front of the dugout with dynamite. I was still awake and heard their horses. Once I realized what they were planning, I did what I could to stop them.
It looks like you did a good job of it. I think we winged a couple of the other bastards, too.
Conrad gestured toward the dead man.
You should take this body to the law in Valverde. The authorities can't ignore the fact that Whitfield's men tried to dynamite your home.
They can't? No offense, Mr. Browning. Well, that shows how little you know about the law. Whitfield can claim that he didn't know anything about it. Just like he'll claim that he didn't send his hired killers over here earlier to harass us. And the sheriff will believe him. Because the Circle D is one of the biggest spreads around here. The law won't side with the likes of us against Whitfield.
Conrad knew the young man was probably right, although things might be different if he threw the weight of his own name behind the McTavishes. Dave Whitfield might be an important man in these parts, but he didn't carry as much influence in the entire territory as Conrad Browning did. The problem was that Conrad had his own mission, and he couldn't allow anything else to get in the way of it.
We appreciate what you've done for us, Mr. Browning. This makes twice you saved us from disaster. If there's anything we can do for you...
You've done plenty.
Conrad suddenly realized that the rain had stopped spattering down on the oilcloth. He moved it aside and looked up at the sky. Stars peeked through here and there. The clouds are beginning to break up. It looked like the storm was over. James dragged the dead man's body into the barn.
Looks like you'll have company for the rest of the night.
They left the horse where it was. Come morning, they could tie ropes to the carcass and drag it off. Conrad didn't figure Whitfield's men would try anything else tonight, after the losses they had already suffered. But after he climbed back into the hayloft, he slept fitfully, waking often to open the loft door and have a look around. Knowing that a dead man lay below him in the barn didn't make him sleep any better either. The atmosphere at breakfast the next morning was subdued. The McTavishes knew their troubles weren't over, not by a long shot. With Conrad's help, they had turned back two attacks on their homestead. But Conrad was leaving, and their enemy Dave Whitfield remained. It was just a matter of time until he struck at them again.
Rory, go out and hitch up Mr. Browning's horse to that buggy.
I can take care of that.
Nope, I don't mind, Mr. Browning. I like working with horses, and those two of yours look like fine animals.
They are.
The buckskin had carried him hundreds of miles already on his quest for justice before he'd started this trip to New Mexico territory in the buggy. Rory went out to the barn, followed by James. Conrad thought the boy looked a little nervous about the idea of going in there where Whitfield's dead gunman lay under a piece of canvas. But Rory wasn't going to let that stop him from carrying out the chore his father had given him.
If you don't mind me prying, Mr. Browning... How did your late wife come to be buried in Valverde?
Her family lived here for a while, and her brothers thought it would be a good place.
I would have thought it'd be up to you to decide such a thing.
I wasn't available at the time. One place is as good as another.
Well, I hope that visiting her grave brings you some peace. I'm begging your pardon again, but you have the look of a haunted man about you.
That was an apt description. He had been haunted since that awful night in Black Rock Canyon. He hoped that settling the score with the people responsible for Rebel's death would lay those ghosts to rest, but he had come to doubt it. He wasn't sure anything would ever ease the pain, but he had learned to function in spite of it. He could even smile from time to time, as he did now.
I appreciate your concern, Mr. McTavish, but I think you have enough problems of your own to deal with without worrying about mine.
'Tis true. Whitfield will be upset that he lost another man.
I'm the one responsible for this death. Tell Whitfield to look for me in Valverde if he wants to take it up with me.
James hurried back inside, an anxious expression on his face.
Rider's coming, Pa.
Whitfield's men.
Not just them. I think the big skookum he-wolf himself is with them this time.
Hamish stood up. He took the shotgun down from its pegs on the wall.
Just let me do the talking. I'd like to get through this without any more killing. And you're a bit of a hothead, James, if I do say so myself.
James looked like he might have argued, but Hamish was already on his way out the door. James followed, loosening the Remington and its holster on his hip as he did so. Conrad still sat at the table, savoring the last of the strong black brew in his cup. Margaret came over to him.
Are you going out there, Mr. Browning?
I am. But before I go, let me say thank you for breakfast, Miss McTavish. It was very good.
You said it yourself. This isn't your fight.
I don't reckon Dave Whitfield will be in much of a mood to listen to explanations right now.
Conrad pushed his chair back and stood up. He hadn't put his coat on yet, but he wore the trousers and vest from his dark gray tweed suit, along with a white shirt and a black string tie. He walked over to the open doorway and leaned a shoulder against the jamb as half a dozen men rode into the yard in front of the dugout. The man in the lead, who rode a big, handsome palomino, was a thick-gutted, barrel-chested hombre. A granite-like slab of jaw dominated his face. He jerked his horse to a halt, and the rough way he handled the reins made Conrad dislike him on sight. The other five men brought their mounts to a stop behind him. Hamish and James faced them, not backing down. Rory watched from the barn doors. Conrad knew the boy had taken his Winchester with him. The rifle was probably leaning against the wall just inside the doors, out of sight. The odds weren't too bad, Conrad thought, instinctively assessing the situation and trying to figure out what would happen if gunplay broke out. They were four against six, and the four of them were spread out a little, while Whitfield and his men were bunched up. That was potentially a tactical mistake on Whitfield's part. But maybe it wouldn't come to shooting.
What are you doing here, Whitfield? You know the change. Welcome on my spread.
I came from a man Dumont.
He's dead.
I figured as much. I hear you got some sort of hired gun working for you now, McTavish. Did he kill Dumont, or was it you or one of your boys?
It was one of your own men who blew himself up, Whitfield. If anyone's to blame for his death, it's the man who sent him over here with dynamite.
Whitfield turned his horse a little so that he could glare murderously at Conrad.
You'd be the hired gun?
No, I'm just passing through these parts on my way to Valverde. I stopped and gave a hand because I didn't like the odds against the McTavishes. That's all.
What's your name, mister?
Conrad Browning.
Whitfield frowned, as if the name was somehow familiar to him and he couldn't place it.
Well, you made a bad mistake by sticking your nose where it ain't welcome, Browning. This bunch you're defending is nothing but a gang of rustlers and murderers.
You're a damn liar, Whitfield! My son told you that to your face, and now I'm telling you.
One of the men edged his horse forward. The man wasn't very impressive looking. Even on horseback, he wasn't very big. The marks of some childhood disease pocked his dark, narrow face. He wore a cowhide vest and a black Stetson pulled down low. A quirly dangled from the corner of his mouth. Conrad knew, though, that appearances were deceptive. The way this man carried himself in the saddle, with his hand never straying far from the butt of his gun, the muscular thickness of his right wrist, the cold, dark eyes, they all added up to the fact that he was a gunslinger. Conrad had grown to know the signs all too well.
Won't we take care of this trash for you, boss?
That's all right, Trace. I can stop my own snakes.
Evidently not. You come visiting with a handful of hired guns at your back.
Because I don't want to wind up with a bullet in my back like three of my riders did when 100 of my cattle disappeared.
We didn't steal your cattle! And we sure as hell didn't shoot any of your men.
What happened to them then?
The border's not all that far away. Banditos could have crossed over, ambushed your men, stolen those cattle, and run them back across into Mexico without much trouble. That sort of thing happens all the time.
It never happened around here till this greasy sack outfit moved in.
Because you run roughshod over everyone else in this part of the country until they're all scared of you. That's a good reason folks call you Devil Dave.
By God, I won't stand for that.
Whitfield's hand started toward his gun. Before it could get there, Conrad's Colt was out and leveled. His draw a flicker of movement hard for the eye to follow. A man called Trace slapped leather as well. Everyone froze. With Conrad's gun pointed at Whitfield and Trace's revolver trained on Conrad.
Put it down, Browning, or you're a dead man.
Not before your boss is.
Without taking his eyes off Whitfield, Conrad's thumb looped over the Colt's hammer was the only thing holding it back. He knew Trace could see that.
For God's sake, pouch that iron, Trace. That lunatic will kill me.
Trace hesitated for a second before lowering his gun.
You're the boss, Mr. Whitfield.
Once Trace lowered his gun, Conrad did the same.
You came for Dumont? His body's in the barn. Take it and welcome to it. Why didn't you drag his horse away while you're at it and save us the trouble?
Whitfield flipped a hand, motioning for his men to take care of retrieving Dumont's body from the barn.
For what it's worth, McTavish, I didn't send those men over here last night with that dynamite. That was their idea.
James glanced over at Conrad with a smirk, as if to say, "See, I told you so."
What about that business yesterday evening? Just before dusk as the storm was moving in.
Your boy caused that ruckus by opening fire with a shotgun. I still got cows going missing, and I sent my men over to ask you if you'd seen anything unusual lately.
Sent them over to accuse us of being thieves, you mean?
Seems to me that you reacted just like guilty men would have.
With his gun at his side, Conrad stepped out of the doorway.
We're not getting anywhere here. The McTavishes have told you that they're not guilty, Whitfield, and in the absence of proof, I think you'd be wise to accept their assurances.
What are you, some sort of lawyer? You talk like one.
No, I'm not a lawyer. But I've been around plenty of them, and I know something about the law. What you're doing amounts to nothing more than a campaign of terror against these people, and you'd be well advised to stop it. Otherwise, the authorities will have to step in.
I'd like to see that.
Whitfield shot Trace a narrow-eyed glance.
I'm a law-abiding man, Mr. Browning. But I won't be stolen from, and I won't allow my men to be shot from ambush without doing something about it.
I don't blame you, but you're on the wrong track here.
We'll see.
A couple of Whitfield's men came out of the barn, leading a horse with Dumont's body draped over the saddle and lashed into place. The two men would have to ride double on the way back to the Circle D. Two more of the men tied ropes to the legs of the dead horse and lashed them around their saddle horns. They began to drag it off, following the men who had taken charge of Dumont's body. That left Whitfield and Trace sitting there for a moment, glaring at the McTavishes and Browning. Whitfield turned away first. Trace lingered a couple of seconds longer, his eyes intent on Conrad. They had taken each other's measure with those draws, Conrad thought. Each of them now knew that the other was fast. They couldn't be sure how fast, though, unless they actually faced each other in a showdown. Conrad could see in Trace's eyes that the little gunman believed that day was coming. All Conrad could do was bite back a disgusted curse. The disgust was directed against himself. Against all his better judgment, he had just involved himself hip-deep in the troubles of the McTavishes. He had made enemies out of Whitfield and Trace, and they weren't the sort of men to forget a confrontation like that. Sooner or later, he'd be forced to deal with them. The added complication wasn't what he needed right then. On the other hand, he realized suddenly, news spread fast, even in sparsely settled country like this. It wouldn't be long before everybody in this part of New Mexico knew that a man named Conrad Browning had ridden in and sided with the McTavishes in their struggle against Devil Dave Whitfield. His first goal had been to resurrect Conrad Browning from the dead. He figured he was well on his way to doing that. Rory brought out the buggy with the black hitch to it and the buckskin tied on behind, as they had been when Conrad arrived. He had his rifle in one hand, the black's reins in the other. Conrad had guessed right about the boy having the Winchester ready in case of trouble.
Here you go, Mr. Browning.
Rory handed over the reins.
It was a pleasure taking care of these fine horses for you.
It looks like you did a good job, too.
He took a coin from his pocket and handed it to Rory.
Thanks.
Ah, that's not necessary, Mr. Browning. Scots are a thrifty folk, as you no doubt know. But that don't mean you have to pay us for our hospitality.
It's not much.
Not much, the man says. Ha! It's double eagle, Paul.
Hamish was about to start protesting again, but Margaret, who had emerged from the dugout once Whitfield and his men were gone, took the coin from Rory.
This will come in mighty handy the next time we go to Valverde to buy supplies, Pa, and you know it. We're cash poor right now. Thank you, Mr. Browning. As much as you've already done for us, I hate to take this, too. But I will.
And you're welcome to it.
Conrad climbed up into the buggy.
Good luck to you.
Conrad flapped the lines against the black's back and got the big horse moving. He didn't look behind him as the buggy rolled away from the McTavish ranch. He hoped that the family's troubles were over, but he knew better. Dave Whitfield was used to getting his own way around there, and with that gunman Trace to back him up and goad him on, Whitfield would continue acting like it was still open range days, when the only law that counted was what a man packed in his holster. The storm the night before had left the ground fairly muddy, with puddles of water standing here and there. But this was a region that didn't see rain all that often, so the thirsty earth quickly sucked up most of the moisture. The sun was out too, helping to dry the mud. Conrad was able to drive around the worst of the muck as he headed south toward Valverde. The name meant Green Valley, and it was appropriate because the settlement was nestled in a small valley watered by a creek. Cottonwoods lined the banks of the stream, and the grass was thicker along it. In this semi-arid landscape, even a little vegetation was enough to qualify as an oasis. The settlement had started out as a wide place in the trail, a trading post and way station on the Butterfield Stagecoach Line. It hadn't been much more than that until the Southern Pacific Railroad came through years later and caused it to grow. It still wasn't a big town by any stretch of the imagination, but it had developed into a fair-sized community with a main street that ran for several blocks, paralleling the train tracks. South of the steel rails were the saloons, gambling dens, and whorehouses, while the respectable folks lived north of the tracks. Also north of the tracks, on the edge of the settlement, was the local mission, and behind the big stone and adobe building with its bell tower was the graveyard. Conrad had been to Valverde before, several years earlier, when he and Frank were passing through this area on the way to the railroad spur that Conrad was building at the time. He recognized the mission's bell tower when he saw it rising in the distance, and he felt a catch in his throat as he thought about the cemetery that it overlooked. His wife was buried in that cemetery. The remains of the beautiful, charming, vibrant young woman who had been Rebel Callahan Browning would lie there for all eternity, cold and lifeless. Conrad didn't allow himself to think too much about that. He was here for a reason, but it wasn't to mourn his wife. He had already done that and would continue to do so, probably for the rest of his life. He was here to avenge her. He drove straight to the Valverde Hotel, which was a block away from the train station. Leaving the buggy tied up at the hitch rail in front of the two-story adobe building, he went inside. The day had grown warm, but the lobby was pleasantly cool because of the thick walls. Conrad crossed the room to the desk, noting as he did so that two men in suits, probably traveling salesmen, sat reading newspapers by the front window. A younger woman in a stylish traveling outfit stood at the desk. She turned away as Conrad came up and gave him a smile in passing. He returned it politely, noting that she was attractive, with honey blonde hair piled in an elaborate arrangement of curls under a fashionable bottle green hat. He felt her looking back and scrutinizing him as she walked away. The clerk, a round-faced man with thinning brown hair, smiled at Conrad.
What can I do for you, sir?
I need a room.
Of course. For how long?
That's hard to say. I expect to be here a few days.
Business or pleasure?
Pardon me?
Is it business or pleasure that brings you to Valverde?
Oh, business, you'd have to say.
Well, then, I hope it's a successful stay for you. If you'll just sign here...
The clerk turned the register book so that it faced Conrad and pushed pen and inkwell forward with the other hand. Conrad scrawled his name in the book, adding Carson City, Nevada after it in the place for his residence. The name on the line above was Angeline Whitfield. That caught his attention, but he didn't show it. The clerk must have been pretty experienced at reading upside down. His eyes widened.
Conrad Browning?
Conrad looked up at him coolly.
That's right. You've heard of me?
I keep up with the financial news as best I can in this backwater town. Of course I've heard of you, Mr. Browning. You're one of the country's leading financiers and industrialists. But I thought...
That I was dead?
Well, yes, sir, that's right. It was reported that you died in a fire in Carson City.
Those reports were premature. I'm alive and well, as you can see for yourself.
But what are you doing in Valverde? Are you going to build another railroad spur? Or... Oh, Lord, I forgot all about... I mean, I'm so sorry.
It's all right. Yes, I'm here to visit my wife's grave, among other things. I'd appreciate being left in peace to do so.
Of course, sir. I'll see to it that you're not disturbed. No one will even know you're here.
Conrad didn't believe that for a second. The clerk had the look of a natural-born gossip, and he figured that the man would be scurrying around town within minutes to spread the word that not only was Conrad Browning still alive, but also that he was there in town to pay his respects at his late wife's grave. That was exactly what Conrad wanted.
Where's the closest livery stable?
It's right down the street. Would you like for me to have someone take your horses down there and have them seen to?
That would be excellent. I have a carpet bag in my buggy, too.
I'll have it brought up to your room. I'll tend to this right away, sir.
The clerk took a key off the rack behind him and held it out.
Room 12. It's the best in the house.
Thank you.
Conrad took the key.
The young lady who was here just before me.
Ah, Miss Whitfield, sir. The daughter of one of the local ranchers. She's come for a visit with him. A very lovely young woman.
Indeed.
Well, that was interesting, he thought as he climbed the stairs. Devil Dave had a daughter who obviously didn't live with him. At least it would have been interesting if it was any of his business, which it wasn't. The hotel room was nice, at least for Valverde. It didn't compare to the finest that Boston or San Francisco had to offer, of course. The bed was a sturdy four-poster, and there was a thickly woven Navajo rug on the floor. Conrad freshened up using the basin of water that sat on the dresser. He dried his face quickly and put his hand on the butt of his gun as he went to the door.
Who is it?
As soon as the words were out of his mouth, he took a quick step to his left and drew the Colt. If it was an ambush, and whoever was in the hall planned on pumping a double load of buckshot through the wall or the door, the odds were on Conrad's side that the would-be killer would miss. Of course, there was still a 1-in-3 chance that he'd be stepping right into the blast.
Got your bag here, Mr. Browning?
Conrad twisted the knob and opened the door. An elderly black man with only a few wisps of white hair left on his head stood there with the carpet bag in his right hand. He had Conrad's Winchester in his left hand.
I brought your rifle, too. Didn't figure you'd need it here in town, but didn't seem like you'd want to leave it at the stable with your buggy and horses and saddle, neither.
Conrad nodded and stepped back. He holstered his gun, noting as he did so that the man hadn't seemed too surprised to see him holding the Colt.
Just put them on the bed.
Conrad gave a casual wave of his left hand toward the four-poster.
Are you the one who took the buggy down to the stable?
Yes, sir, I am.
The man placed the carpet bag and the rifle on the bed, as Conrad had indicated.
Name's Linus.
Well, thank you, Linus.
The man wore a suit coat and a string tie over a white shirt.
I take it you work at the hotel?
Yes, sir. General factotum to Mr. Rowlett, who owns the place. That was him down at the desk when you checked in. Factotum means
a man of many jobs. I sort of fit that description myself.
Yes, sir. I heard about you. You got mines and banks and railroads to run. Matter of fact, I used to work for you myself.
You did?
Yes, sir. I was a brakeman on that spur line you built over west of here till I got too stove up to handle a job. Then I worked as a porter for a while. Finally decided I wanted to settle down in one place, though, which fella can't hardly do if he works on the rails.
No, that's true. Well, it's good to meet you, Linus.
Conrad handed the man a silver dollar.
Thank you for bringing my things from the stable. I assume that if I need anything else...
You just let me know.
Actually, there is one thing I'd like to know. You're aware that my wife is buried here in Valverde?
Yes, sir. I'm mighty sorry for your loss.
Do you know if her grave has been well cared for?
Oh, yes, sir. It sure has. Father Francisco down at the mission wouldn't have no other way.
Thank you. I appreciate knowing that.
If you don't mind my asking, sir... Did you come to visit her?
That's exactly why I'm here, Linus.
The more people who knew that, the better. And he figured the old man would help spread the word. He felt certain that whoever had hired Clay Laswell to carry out the kidnapping would have heard about Laswell and the rest of the outlaws being killed off one by one. The mastermind would have to wonder about that and even ask himself if it was possible that Conrad could still be alive, despite the reports from Carson City. Conrad's hope was that the man would have someone keeping an eye on Rebel's grave, just in case. It was even possible that the man was here in Valverde himself, watching to see if Conrad would turn up at the cemetery. If that turned out to be true, then within days, or even hours, Conrad might find himself face to face with the man who had taken away everything precious in life to him.
Mr. Brown?
What is it?
For a minute there, you looked like you was ready to kill somebody, Mr. Brown, and you surely did.
Not at all.
Of course, he lied. He was ready to kill somebody. He was more than ready. Conrad went downstairs a few minutes after Linus left the hotel room. There was no point in postponing the inevitable. When he reached the lobby, though, he found a surprise.
Mr. Browning!
Conrad saw Angeline Whitfield approaching him. She had taken off the hat from her traveling outfit, but still wore the same dress. And she still looked lovely. She smiled as she came up to him and offered him her hand.
Mr. Browning, you don't know me, but I once saw you in Philadelphia. A friend of mine pointed you out to me. I hope you don't think it too forward of me to introduce myself like this. I'm Angeline Whitfield.
Miss Whitfield?
Conrad took her hand. Her skin was cool and smooth.
It is Miss Whitfield?
Yes, of course.
Her fingers lingered in his.
As for being too forward, well, times are changing, aren't they?
Indeed they are. In less than 5 years, it'll be a whole new century.
Without being rude about it, Conrad slipped his hand out of hers.
What can I do for you, Miss Whitfield?
I'm sure you have no way of knowing this, but my father has a ranch about 20 miles north of here. I just arrived for a visit, and I'm a couple of days early. Father won't send a wagon for me until the day after tomorrow. So I was wondering if I might prevail upon you to escort me to the ranch. I can't make the trip alone, of course. It wouldn't be proper.
Not to mention it might not be safe. But I'm not sure it would be proper for me to accompany you, either.
Why, of course it would, Mr. Browning. You're a gentleman, after all. And once we're there, I think it would be perfectly charming if you spent a few days on the ranch, if your schedule would permit it. I know you must be a very busy man, what with all of your business interests.
Miss Whitfield, perhaps you haven't heard. I was married.
Married? No. I had no idea. Wait a minute, you said was?
That's right. My wife passed away several months ago.
Oh, my lord. I'm so sorry, Mr. Browning. I didn't know about your loss. I didn't mean to be so... you must forgive me.
Of course. And I wish I could help you, but under the circumstances...
Conrad lifted a hand as if to say there was nothing he could do. Although, he thought, with the shadow of a grim smile hovering around his mouth, it might have been interesting to see Dave Whitfield's reaction if the man who had befriended the McTavishes had ridden up to the Circle D with his daughter for a visit.
I understand. I won't trouble you any longer.
No trouble. I'm glad to meet you. I hope you enjoy your visit on your father's ranch.
And I hope no more hell breaks loose while you're there, he added to himself, for the McTavishes' sake. Conrad tugged on the brim of his hat, excused himself, and left the hotel. His steps turned toward the mission. He steeled himself for what lay before him. Then he walked up the street to the graveyard, where his wife was buried.